Hey, I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, host and producer of San Diego News Now, which is KPBS's daily news podcast. Today, we're highlighting two of KPBS's arts and culture podcasts. Port of Entry is KPBS's bilingual cross-border podcast that features stories from here in our border region. And The Finest highlights the people, arts, and movement that define San Diego County. This hour features conversations with the teams behind these podcasts who produce and make them, along with the highlights from some of the best episodes from the podcast themselves. This is Best of KPBS Podcast. Hey, I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, and this is Best of KPBS Podcast. Port of Entry tells cross-border stories about arts, culture, immigration, identity, and belonging. The show is hosted by Alan Lilienthal and Natalie Gonzalez-Rodriguez. It's sound designed by Adrian Villalobos and produced by Julio Ortiz Franco, who joins me right now. What's up, man? How are you?
Man, good. Good to be here.
Good, man. I'm so happy to have you. Port of Entry is a, I think it's such a central important podcast to our region. Obviously, we're a bi-national podcast and region covering both San Diego and Tijuana. What about it and what about this border region made you decide that you really had to tell these stories, Julio?
Well, just by its very nature, I mean, it's a sense of place. Mm-hmm. It's San Diego, a perspective beyond its sort of geographical boundaries, specifically to the south. Mm-hmm. That's one. Two is that there's every day people just cross the border and to the numbers, I guess, hundreds of thousands of people, I think, is the last statistic I checked. And I grew up being one of those people that crossed the border for school, for work. Still do. I split my time between Tijuana and San Diego. So, yeah, it's just the podcast theme hits very close to home. It's basically the whole team is composed of people of border crossers. And so, yeah, it's talking about ourselves, the culture that we grew up in, what makes us basically tick, how basically when something happens in Washington, what does the fallout look like down here? And so, yeah, so that's basically what draws us to tell these sorts of stories.
Absolutely. And, you know, from your point of view, it's such a unique and important point of view. It's important to listen and kind of get really the personal intel as far as how life shapes for you. You know, we talked about, I know we're a local news entity, but I think, you know, it's so important that we do acknowledge the very obvious border that's right there. And like you said, the hundreds of thousands of people that are commuting. What about us being a border region do you think shaped San Diego as a region? I feel like it's such a unique culture because it's so many shared persons. But maybe could you talk just a little bit about growing up here and kind of having the benefit, but also I'm sure and sometimes the struggle of being between both worlds?
I mean, yeah, it's just that it was the first time I crossed the border for school. It was a complete culture shock because I wasn't, say, in a sense, knowing all the nuances of how, say, race was handled in or language was handled in San Diego or say Chula Vista or San Isidro, even though there was a lot, the demographic was presence of Mexican nationals was significant, but that in itself plays into how I say cities and towns are composed by different sorts of threads of culture from all parts of the world. So not just being Mexican. Mexican obviously dominates because we're the neighbors to the south. I mean, and so yeah, it enriches the lives of anybody who just wants to get to know anybody else or your neighbor. You don't have to go. I guess the best way to describe it is a conversation between neighbors. So when you go to a friend's neighbor's barbecue or just knock on the door and just try to find out who they are, what makes them tick, what makes them sad. So that sort of curiosity drives me, drives the podcast and the questions that we ask. And specifically, how does this, and when we try to come up with an episode, is how does this story in a way makes people crosses the border or makes the people cross the border, or say the aspirations of the solutions that, that they want to bring forth crosses the border, and how does it impact both sides?
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk about the production. Let's talk about a little bit of work, a little bit of your job. Start to finish, take us through what goes into producing Port of Entry.
So, I mean, one of the central questions that we asked is, obviously we had to make it central to the theme of the episode, is that of a crossing borders. And so we ask the story of something, we have an idea. How is that story crossing the border in a way? So it can be, say, theoretically, like somebody was inspired by something that happened across the border. Like, for example, we did for the episode of the fight for equal marriage in Baja. And so the advocates and activists were inspired by what happened north of the border. And so you see how that those ideas cross the border. For other podcasts, it's just people who just lived in San Diego, work in San Diego, and just come back. And so something a bit more physical. Or some people just has a hustle, like a cross-border hustle. And so, yeah, so basically that's how we try to shape the episode, asking and trying to answer that central question. And then from that on is just typical production stuff, which is you have to filter sources. You're asking who's the right people to interview. Are they compelling enough? What's the big story behind it? What's the big impact? As of late, some of the bigger questions have been asked is does this have a national point of relevance? And so we try to look for those stories that do. For instance, when the Trump administration, canceled or stopped the temporary protected status for, say, Venezuelan citizens, got in contact with a refugee who made it through across the border via Tijuana and now is in California. And we heard her story of how she left Venezuela. So that sort of impact that we tried to show, that what happens in, say, Washington kind of has its own unique way of effervescing here in the San Diego Tijuana region. And from that, I guess we interview, then we write the story, we obviously record, we track, and then we have a sound edit, and then when we're happy with it, we distribute it.
Absolutely. I love it. Naturally, Port of Entry has a Spanish and an English version. Does producing a bilingual podcast change at all the way you tell stories? I know sometimes there isn't, you know, the direct translation for the way certain things will be phrased. You know, they'll say like, you know, I don't know how to say in English, but I'll say this. Does it have any indication on how you like tell that story when you're translating it from English over to Spanish?
Absolutely. I mean, there's naturality in some of the going about of production that is much more closer to us because we are much more familiar with the source material and between each other because the we talk to each other in our mother tongues. And so that kind of finds its way through in how we write the episodes when we are translating them. But it's also very important to note that it's important that we have something for the people that we interview that they don't speak the English language. And so one of the key things when I took over the show was to have sort of the Spanish counterpart to English episodes. I told the team, I remember telling them, it's kind of like telling folks, having people, inviting them to help you cook, but not having them enjoy the meal with you. See what I'm saying? So that sort of two-tiered system was in something that didn't necessarily sit well with me. So I said, we have to find a way to make this happen. And so everybody kind of was very excited because it was something that they were trying to do, but didn't have the right people at the time. So when I spoke to our former supervisor, Lisa, she said, of course, let's do it. And so from then on, right, episode one, till now, like 40, 45 episodes later, every single one has a Spanish counterpart, with the exception of a few that were live events.
I love it. I love it. I'm sure the feedback on that has been positive. I'm sure, you know, there are people, like you said, that would prefer to listen to it in your mother tongue, which is exactly the language you use, you know, because there's just little nuances. And, you know, I've taken Spanish my entire life and it's just like one arm reach away. You know what I mean? Because it's like each trip I take, you know, they might speak Catalan or they might speak more like Dominican Spanish like we spoke or, you know, just different dialects. So I like listening to the Spanish versions as well. Okay. I pick up every third or fourth. Same thing with the radio out here when we talk about cross-border region. You know, I like to play my little Mexican stations here and there just to keep me in the conversation, in the mix. Even though word for word, I'm like, yeah, don't test me. Don't ask me everything.
For the listeners, the other day, Lawrence came up to me and said, ¿Qué tranza, bro? Completely by surprise. I wasn't expecting it. So, yes, he is fluent in Spanish.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well-cultured. I tell him all the time. I got the culture side. It's the exact language. I'm like, ¿Cómo se dice? Let me pull up my app. ¿Cómo se dice?
You should pull up to a couple more carne asada.
Exactly. There we go. No, exactly. More community.
Exactly.
Today on Best of KPBS Podcast, we're highlighting an episode from Emilio Montiel, a Mexican filmmaker who built his own movie empire. How did the team meet Emilio Montiel, and what drew you to his story initially? I know he's doing really good social numbers in Mexico, and also he has people on both sides of the border watching his videos.
Yeah. So I first caught wind of Emilio through Matt Bowler, who's on one of our colleagues, one of the VJs here, and he just sent me this trailer for what would seem to be the corniest looking trailer, and that it's like was I remember watching it, thought it was like a train wreck. It was what I thought, so bad, but then you got hooked. And as I started—
So bad it's good. That's a thing.
Yeah, so I started going into it, and the more I looked into them, I start checking my own prejudices about what film should look like. And so when I got in contact with Emilia, I found out, I got to meet somebody who's has a lighthearted way of approaching just creating film. And so in a way, he has built trust and relationships with the people he's worked with for over 30 years. And so he's met some of the biggest names in Mexican Western narco thing. And so he's worked with the Almada brothers. He's close friends with Bernabe Bernudez or El Gatillero, all these big names that you would find in these typical Mexican Western films. And so what drew us to him was this, just like, how is it possible that there's so much out, that he has put so much out there that we don't notice, but yet some people love. You see some of his views that are in the 5 to 4 million. These are movies that some stuff that comes out of Hollywood doesn't make 100,000.
With 10 times the budget, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So he puts these films together with a shoestring budget. I'm talking about somewhere around $5,000 to $7,000 per movie. And he's putting out these about, I guess, good from 6 to 12 each year. Somewhere around, the average is about 8 movies. But yeah, it's just, he just sprints like the first 2 to 3 months, takes a break, then sprints again, and then he produces 3 to 4 movies like every quarter. And so it's amazing that he's able to inspire so much. There's a lot of people in Tijuana who've actually interned for him. So there's more to the story, to his story, than just meets the eye. And so that's what we found really, really interesting, specifically for the team who we have our prejudices and are like our snobby attitude when it comes to film. So we asked ourselves, does it need to come from Hollywood to make itself valuable? So that was sort of the question that we asked when we did that episode.
Yeah, it almost begs the question of, is all this necessary? The expensive equipment, the top tier editing, like I said, he really serves as like a hub and almost a conduit to the Mexican film industry and kind of like that content creation vibe of like, if you're creative and we have a role that works for you, yeah. it can go. So I think it's super talented. And like you said, it's one of those things like you got to check out and see, and which we will right now. So we're going to toss to that episode from Mexican filmmaker Emilio Montiel.
Growing up in a Mexican household, Sundays often meant Cantinflas reruns or other classics from Mexico's golden age of cinema.
But the films that really had our tíos glued to the screen?
The big great Mexican westerns.
Policía Federal, deténgase!
Like the scene that you just heard. Two bad guys trying to drive a load of narcotics through a police checkpoint. Even the most inexperienced viewer would notice the awkward editing cuts, the laughable fight scenes, and the ever-present robotic acting.
Exactly. Those are the movies we mean. Everyone seemed captivated wherever they played.
Yo ya no aguanto una noche más en esta hacienda. El miedo es más grande que yo.
Ahora
men in tejanas or cowboy hats, in off-road trucks, AK-47s tucked under their arms, a battle of narcos versus police, or
a battle for the heart.
These films are not good by Hollywood standards. In Mexico, they're derogatorily referred to as churros.
Films with poor acting, weak scripts, and a low production budget. And growing up with these films, that's all we thought they were, just bad movies.
Then, we met someone who completely changed how we saw them.
In front of the camera stands actor, singer, and producer Emilio Montiel.
Ya te digo, Ceci, mis dos hombres de confianza traicionaron.
He's 5'7", wearing a fancy suit, a thick mustache, and a tejana typical of wealthy cowboys. At a glance, he could pass for late Mexican singer Vicente Fernandez.
Emilio has produced hundreds of these type of movies, and we are on the set of his latest film, La Herencia.
Spanish for the inheritance. Today, he's playing a wealthy landowner. He's standing in the living room of an old but luxurious house, surrounded by his three adult children.
They are confronting him one by one about being cut off from their inheritance.
Tú nos engañaste. Hijo loco, te veo peor que antes.
Déjalo, ya lo acosarán los remordimientos.
Behind the camera is a ragtag crew of three juggling multiple roles. The director doubles as the main cameraman, the assistant director as the lighting gaffer, and the sound operator will also edit the film.
Despite being a small crew, they are remarkably effective, coordinating and executing each scene seamlessly as they progress through the day's shoot.
Señor Villarreal, con permiso.
The filming is briefly interrupted by a correction the director, Javier Cruz, makes to 6'2" white American actor Rory Pendergast.
And the scene concludes as Emilio rests his hand on the waist of a young woman as he walks out of frame and towards a terrace overlooking the Rosarito Sea.
Emilio plans to produce four movies over the next 2 to 3 months. Each will take about 2 weeks to shoot, with total production costs around $40,000.
This particular movie will be ready to be screened by May.
But not on the big screen. This movie is going directly to YouTube.
Emilio's movies don't have the reach to make it to theaters. They are created on a shoestring budget, usually with an inexperienced cast looking to break into the acting world.
And that shows. The acting leaves a lot to be desired.
But Emilio is fully aware of this, and so is his audience.
100 million of them. Every time one of his movies is uploaded to YouTube, commenters rush to show how much they love Emilio's films.
Each film attracts 250,000 to 500,000 views, with some reaching an impressive 5 to 10 million.
So, if so many people love these films, are they really that bad? From KPBS, this is Port of Entry,
where we tell cross-border stories that connect us.
I'm Alan Lilienthal.
And I'm Natalie Gonzalez.
¿Cómo está?
Bien, bien, gracias a Dios.
Mucho gusto.
Gracias, Julio.
Aquí.
Gracias, gracias.
A week prior to being on set, our producer Julio first met Emilio at his headquarters, a small house in the Santa Fe neighborhood, a working-class area on the outskirts of Tijuana between the city and Rosarito.
Y como pagaba siempre hotel, entonces, ¿por qué no me lo llevo a Rosarito? Más privado, y entonces tengo todo mi archivero, tengo mi computadora aquí.
He explains that the house doubles as an office, storage for his equipment and films, and sometimes lodging for his cast and crew.
¿Ese es usted cantando?
Sí, sí, no soy yo.
Once inside, one of Emilio's movies is playing on a wall-mounted TV. In that scene, he lip-syncs to a song he wrote while serenading a woman on the beach in Playas de Tijuana.
Y aquí ahorita estaba mirando, también tengo...
O sea, ¿canta y baila?
También, pero ahorita no. Pero ahorita casi puro nomás.
Emilio sings, he acts, and he even used to dance. At first glance, you might not expect such a diverse talent from a man of his appearance. But just like his films, there's much more to him than meets the eye.
Sí, y nosotros, yo y otro hermano que en paz descanse, nos íbamos a la línea en aquellos años.
Emilio was born in Oakland, California, but grew up in a shanty home in Tijuana's old Hidalgo neighborhood. He was one of eight children.
After his father left, Emilio and his siblings began helping to support the family as soon as they were old enough to work.
Estábamos tristes porque, pues, a los 8 años mi papá nos dejó. Entonces, pues, no, como ahora sí, como dicen, ¿no? Las letras, como dicen, cuando tienes hambre, las letras no entran.
He says hunger kept him from learning. Schoolwork just couldn't compete with the need for food.
Duré 4 años de primero en primaria. A los 16 salí de sexto y era el hombre más feliz. ¡Ay, yo soy Junior!
De sexto de primaria.
He repeated first grade 4 times and didn't finish sixth grade until he was 16.
Y nos íbamos a la línea, pues, a vender chicles, periódico y ayudarle a la gente a sacar el mandado, a echarle el mandado.
To help his family, he sold gum and newspapers at the border and bagged groceries in San Isidro, where he recalls being fired 19 times for eating the merchandise.
Vamos a decir, de 12, 15 años. Me corrieron 19 veces. 19 veces me corrieron.
He gave school a last shot in his 20s, enrolling in adult school in San Diego to pick up English, a skill that eludes him to this day.
But the teacher caught him flirting with girls instead of focusing, and he was promptly kicked out.
Usted no viene a estudiar, usted no viene a andar aquí de ahora sí, como dicen, ¿no? De caliente aquí, andar molestando a las muchachas. No, ¿qué pasó?
That was the extent of his academic development. By his own admission, everything he learned in life, he learned outside the classroom.
Ya tenía 23 años, yo creo 22, 23 años. Y todo lo que he aprendido, pues lo aprendí en la calle.
School just wasn't his thing.
Perhaps he was just a fish in the wrong pond.
Once again, this is Best of KPBS Podcast. Today we're featuring excerpts and clips. We're here with a producer who puts together the Port of Entry podcast. We just heard an episode from Mexican filmmaker Emilio Montiel in the Baja California film scene. Talk about building trust. You know, I know that we're talking about people, you know, there is a sense of community. Talk about building the trust with that source and what came out of it, the piece that came out of it, the success that came out of it.
Yeah, so first of all, Emilio is very approachable. He's a very nice guy. When you see him from afar, you swear he looks like Vicente Fernandez. And he plays into that sort of thing. So he's approachable, he's nice, he's charismatic. But just showing up and just being there behind this thing, just chatting here and there, just, you know, whenever they catch a break, that helps, you know, develop that trust. And he's also looking for more exposure, obviously. And so he's a willing source, and so that kind of plays well into what we're trying to achieve. And just showing up every day and just chatting, talking. And so to the point that he invites us to be part actors in or have cameos in his movies. And so if you heard the episode, you can hear – if you listen to the episode Real Rebel, you have Emilio invites us into cameo. And so I am a news reporter and you can see my face there. And also Alan, for another movie, was a grumpy lawyer. And so, yeah, it's a lot of fun. But yeah, so
for some reason, I feel like he nailed that role for some reason. You know, so did he have the colored glasses? Did he have colored shades?
No, not that bad. He had to take him off.
That would have been too good. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of almost don't give yourself credit there when you say, like, you know, he was a willing subject and he was an open subject. And, of course, I think, you know, to some extent, people are always looking for good press. But I would argue that, you know, part of the reason you all get that positive reception from him is because you're from his backyard. You guys, you know, share culture and community. And at any point did he say he's proud to see you all producing a podcast in English and Spanish, cross-border, for a public entity? And did that conversation come up at all?
I mean, I don't think he was too familiar with the podcast world. He understood it, but he's kind of stuck in his own micro universe. But he's happy just to make friends and meet new people, and just to kind of flock his feathers a bit to new people, as they say, because you see what it takes to put his movies together on set. And so he's a fish in his own water. And so if you're with him, he's happy to receive you and everything. Obviously the whole team is comprised of very charismatic people. And so we also have that sort of allure, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. One last question from about Emilio. Yeah. What do you think, you know, telling his story showcases and speaks to regarding our San Diego-Tijuana border region? You know, what was the reception like on this side from people reaching out really from San Diego? And then was there anybody in Mexico who was like, oh, I've been watching Montiel's videos and, you know, thanks for featuring him. What was their reaction? And then what was the goal of really showcasing him, you think?
Some of the reception that I received from people who were involved in his outer circle or his sort of team or the outer members, that they loved the episode, how he depicted that sort of a dynamic of what takes to put one of his movies together. So they're really happy that we were able to portray that sort of things that kind of get looked over. And so, the reception was really well. He liked the episode, and so that's all we worry about. You like the episode, I'm happy about it. All right, we don't do gotcha journalism at KPBS or at Port of Entry. So we just try to tell these in depth stories about what makes him, you know, human, how we can relate to them. And so I kind of laid that bare, the sort of obstacles he faced when he was starting his career as a filmmaker. And so that, to make it more personable. And I think we did a good job with that.
You did a great job with that, as your entire team does. Once again, I've been speaking with Julio Ortiz Franco, who is one of the key members behind Port of Entry podcast. This is Best of KPBS podcast. Julio, thank you so much for your time, man.
Thank you, Lawrence.
That was a Port of Entry's podcast episode about filmmaker Emilio Montiel. You can listen to this episode and many others from Port of Entry wherever you get your podcast. We'll be back after the break to showcase our next featured podcast, The Finest. Please don't go anywhere. I'm Lawrence K. Jackson, and this is Best of KPBS Podcast. The Finest explores the San Diego region's arts and culture scene through conversations with artists, performers, filmmakers, writers, and creative leaders who are shaping the region's cultural identity. The show is produced by Anthony Wallace, audio engineered by Ben Redlosk, and hosted by Julia Dixon Evans, who joins me now. Hi, Julia.
Hey, Lawrence. Thanks
What's
for having me.
What's going on? No, thank you for being here. Thank you for being here. The Finest is relatively new, and I think the key word there is like relatively. It's like medium new, you know? It's got enough growth under it.
It's like a toddler.
Exactly, exactly.
Podcast years, dog
it,
years.
It knows those first words, you know? What was the initial inspiration for the podcast?
I mean, we really just wanted to go deeper, right, in arts and culture. Like, on the one hand, this is such a vibrant arts town. Like, there's so much going on. And it often feels like, me at least in my work, like I'm just only scratching the surface. Like, here's a quick list of what's happening right now, of upcoming events. But I think, like, what's really interesting is the way that local creatives, like, show up time and time again and are just, like, making work in the background. And not just, like, artists and musicians, people on the front lines of culture, like food, businesses, history, like people who are building community. I think there's like a lot of really interesting things going on there. And of course, also, yes, art and music.
Yes.
And I've been working in arts journalism for like a pretty good length of time in San Diego. And I really love everything that's out there. And like sometimes it can be hard to swallow, like something that's a little more experimental. But I also feel like everything is and can be so much more accessible and relatable when you know the stories behind the art, right? Like, you know what inspires the artist. And I would like to think that this podcast is a way to share that. Like, I find myself feeling really lucky all the time that I get to sit down with creative people and just, like, ask them sometimes pretty dumb questions and sometimes, like, the big questions, like, what their art means or what music their parents listened to when they were kids or, like, why they opened that cafe. And I think the podcast is also a way of turning that around so everybody who's listening can get to know these people so deeply as well. And I guess the other thing that really, like, motivated and inspired us as the podcast is Anthony Wallace, the producer, and I were also really interested in putting things in context, like, whether in history or in science or larger trends. So, like, we love working on these, like, documentary-style episodes where we get to, you know, talk to scholars and, you know, put things in this broader sense of meaning or why it matters, or here's why, like, maybe you don't have this exact experience, but this is how it could connect to something bigger that's going on that does affect you. So yeah, that's, there's so much going on, and it's really great to be able to, like, dig deep and look at the big picture like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And The Finest does just that. A key word, and a word that I'm sure will come up once or twice more, is creativity. A lot of the conversations on the podcast reveal more of the personal side of creativity, what goes on, the struggles, the risks, the inspiration. Let's talk about who is featured on The Finest, if we can name drop a little, who we have featured on the Finest podcast, Julia.
Yeah, I mean, we have had so many people on the episodes throughout the year and a half. And, like, a couple of examples come to mind. Like, one is surrealist painter who's local, Mary June. And the reason we talked to her is she stopped dreaming. And, you know, as a surrealist, a lot of, like, your art is inspired by your dreams. And so she lost her muse. And it was when she started trying to treat her sleep apnea. She went on a CPAP machine, stopped dreaming. So she had to balance, like, do I make art or do I take care of my health? So we talked about that a little bit. We've talked to animators. This is on our latest episode. We talked to a bunch of animators, people who've worked for Pixar, people who are working in San Diego right now to talk about AI, the impact of generative AI on animation. We've talked to birders, like people who were going for, like, the highest count of birds bird watched in the county, people who run clubs like a Mahjong club in San Diego, the people from Burn All Books about risograph printing. And we talked to a bunch of local musicians and experts as well about music, music economy, and yeah, cafes. Paru Tea was actually our first episode, a little matcha shop.
I love it. I love it. My personal favorite was the birders one. Full disclosure, my grandma bought me a pair of binoculars, and they had a digital camera feature.
No way.
I was like a super unofficial urban birder.
You're a birder.
Just from my window, and I was just
love
like
this.
Another pigeon spotted picture. what do you hope listeners discover when they listen to these stories? And what do you hope they learn about our community, about San Diego, when they listen to The Finest podcast?
I mean, just that there is this strong creative side to San Diego that maybe they didn't know about, or maybe they brushed it aside. But yeah, that, and I just hope it makes people more curious.
I love that. I love that. We're going to jump into an episode of The Finest here. During this episode, we, of course, hear from a local artist, and you take us through the ups and downs of his career. What made you decide to use his story to explore really larger industry trends, almost like the challenge at times of being an artist?
I mean, I think the big thing with Shua, who is the musician, is that, first of all, he's just, like, really good. Like, he's an amazing musician. His voice is mesmerizing. And, I mean, other than that, he's just really candid. Like, he is willing to talk about the hard stuff. He's willing to talk about, like, what it takes to make a living as an artist. So, like, one thing that we were really drawn to him about is, like, how he intentionally decided, like, I'm going to go all in on music, and I'm going to stitch together a career, and maybe one day I will be able to just perform my own music. But for now, I have to do, like, this church gig, and I'm doing this other thing where I'm, like, a gig musician, and then I'm also doing my own music. So, like, hearing about the nuances and the realities of that was, like, that was, he was such a great candidate for talking about that.
Absolutely. So let's get to know The Finest podcast and Shua just a little bit more in this episode.
Cool. Am I good to go?
Yeah, you're good.
When you think of a professional musician, maybe you think of glamour, Taylor Swift, and private jets. But the reality for most musicians is very far from that.
There are points at which I like had no gas, no food, and I was like, well, I'm stuck here. So I'm going to have to take my instrument and go to a corner and just start playing.
Meet Southeast San Diego artist Shua, who first came on my radar through last year's NPR Tiny Desk contest. Can I call at 1-8? His voice is stunning. Feeling like a wreck again, tempted to cut myself in two. And his music's hard to pin down genre-wise. A mix of Bon Iver, Stevie Wonder, and Frank Ocean. It's my fault. I ain't prayed enough at all. Shua's career has taken him from the euphoric high of signing a record deal as a teenager to being on the brink of homelessness just a few years later. Now, approaching 30, things are looking brighter. He's got well over a million streams on Spotify. And he's found support from his fans on Patreon to help fund his work as a musician, stuff like recording projects and music videos. Yet despite this success, his original music doesn't pay all the bills, at least not yet. Now he's a father with two kids, and the stakes are even higher.
I have a family, and we have to, you know, live and eat. And right now we're in a season where I'm the only one that's working, so it's working out, but it's also very much a time of mystery. It takes a lot of hard work. Like, hey, $10.99 a month will get you access to every piece of art that's ever existed, every song. It kind of makes everything less valuable. And, you know, and so you have to either be a viral pop star or almost you're nothing.
Shua's right that cheap Spotify subscription gives us everything we could ever want. But at what cost to the artist? The fact is, in recent years, the divide between the very top artists and everyone else has been getting a lot worse. The numbers are staggering. The top 1% of artists now take home more than 50% of all concert revenue, while most musicians earn less than $20,000 a year. The music industry is a microcosm of the wealth gap in our society. Economists have called it a superstar economy, where a small elite thrives while everyone else struggles. We'll examine how music streaming and market forces have reshaped the industry for both music makers and listeners. And we'll ask why it matters. Why those of us who aren't professional musicians, like me, and probably you, should care. We're all familiar with the starving artist trope, but you might not realize just how difficult our society makes it for people to survive as musicians. Yes, this is a story about numbers and statistics, and the numbers are bad, dire even. But this is really a story about one person, one musician. Okay, I'm going to start with a big question, and that is, why is it essential for you to make music, to be a musician?
Oh, that is a big question. There's never been a point in history where humans have not made art. No matter the level of trouble or danger around the corner, war, famine, et cetera, people are always making art. So I think it's essential because it's reminding me that I'm human personally. I'm like, okay, I'm human. I am here. I matter. My story matters. My background and my culture matters. Maybe my faith matters. Like all these things, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, what was music like for you?
Well, I grew up in a very religious household, so you know, it was a lot of gospel music. It wasn't kind of like there's a whole thing now that's like the sort of evangelical music that kind of copies U2. But when I was growing up, of course, I'm not white. So I grew up kind of in the black, like gospel space. So my father was listening to these artists called The Winans, Fred Hammond, and a smattering of Stevie Wonder and Bill Withers and all that sort of stuff. And I loved it all. And then, you know, music and movies as well. Disney movies, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. That makes me think about one of your songs. It's called Plaza Cuernavaca.
Yeah, yeah. When I was little, I was terrified of the dark. Terrified of the dark. And so, you know, we had our little nightlight, but for some reason, the nightlight wasn't enough. So we had three different tapes that I would switch between. It was one was a gospel CD that I loved listening to, and another was Jungle Book, and the other one was Beethoven. I beg them, let me fall asleep to Jungle Book. The melodies, the harmonies, they have a shock. I'd go between the three, and so I would, for years of my life, I would fall asleep listening to those three things. And so I was like, I just want to write a song about my kind of love affair with music and where it began and where it's tortured me in other ways. Some of the first times in my life I had experienced depression, you know, the sort of dark places that my mind would go to as even just really young, 10, 11, listening to, you know, Stevie Wonder or listening to a Coldplay song, and the sort of catharsis and emotional resonance of those things would legitimately chase away those sort of dark thoughts that told me the life wasn't worth living. And I guess I'd just keep on going because I'd like more people to say, like, hey, the work that you're doing has really helped me. I try to imagine that it's a healthy balance of people just like the music and it's mm-hmm. just, oh yeah, this is just nice to listen to. And also there's some kid out there or adult out there that's saying, oh, this is life sustaining. There was a period of my life, kind of when I started out on this journey, where I got a little baby record deal when I was 18. It started in 2013, I believe, and then in 2016 it ended. It was pretty soul crushing because I really believed in it. I really thought it was going to be the moment and that would be my life from there on. But I'd given up essentially at 2016. I was like, I don't know what I thought I was going to do, but I think I was just coasting, trying to figure it out. I had a lot of depression. I was dealing with a lot of suicidal ideation. It was a period of about 2 years where I was couch surfing because I would try to find a friend mm-hmm. like to stay with. Mm-hmm. I was definitely wandering around and sleeping in my car or sleeping on a couch and just trying to figure things out. I was like, okay, I'm getting in my car and I'm going to pretend like I'm going to drive away right now. But I don't have any gas in here, and I don't have any plans of getting any money to get where I'm going to get next. There are points at which I like had no gas, no food, and I was like, well, I'm stuck here, so I'm going to have to take my instrument and go to a corner and just start playing and hoping that somebody gives me enough money to go get a gas canister and then fill that up and go to my car, which is like, let me, you know, and it's worked. I mean, it doesn't work,
yeah.
Mind you. It's not a sustainable way of life. But it was also like, what? I'm 19. Like, this is what you're supposed to do. It's not. And I didn't know that either. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not what all 19-year-olds do. And so it was really hard. But I had a couple friends that, you know, basically kind of wouldn't let me give up. Mm. I'm like, yeah, you're not going to, you don't get to do this. Like, right. You don't get to quit. And so a couple years later, they're basically like, you're gonna record this song that you wrote. Because I kept on writing songs. And I would do like a house backyard show every once in a while. So they're like, you're going to record the song. Then I was like, okay. And I got excited about it. I recorded a little song and I expected nothing to happen with it. But I put it online and I was like, maybe 1,000 people will listen to this. Mm. That would be awesome. But you know, it is what it is now, you know, over 1 million plays, or I'd like to think of it as 1 million people. You can only go on pieces. And it happened, you know, the million plays happened after the record deal, after I had given up.
After that early hit, You Can Only Go in Pieces, Shua decided to devote his life and career to music. But things from there were far from easy.
And so, you know, right now it is a battle to have the margin to actually create what I think needs to be seen and heard in the world.
Mm.
But I have a family and we have to, you know, live and eat. And right now we're in a season where I'm the only one that's working. So it's working out, but it's also very much a time of mystery.
Mm. Would you say a couple years ago when you became a dad, of course it's pivotal. It's a big deal. But in terms of your approach to the music career and your idea of what financial stability might look like, how did that square away?
The level of responsibility that I felt, and I started thinking about my life when I was a kid, and I was like, I want this guy to have like an awesome life. And of course, kids don't really worry. They don't think about that stuff. If we ate the same thing every day and it was, you know, like I did, like red beans and rice or whatever, and like syrup sandwiches, which that wasn't my whole life, but there are periods when I was a kid. I just wanted him to have a good life. And so I think it put a bit of fire under me to be like, okay, so let me take stock. What are my skills? Oh, just playing music. Okay, great. That's it. I guess I'm going to have to really figure this out. There's no plan B.
Once again, I'm here with Julia Dixon Evans. This is Best of KPBS Podcast. Julia, thank you for joining me. What kind of research went into explaining the realities of the music industry? This is another episode. I love the corners that you all hit. You know, we're getting a little art if you're interested. You're getting a little music industry. We can always talk about the really struggle of the creative, right? Which is kind of an overarching umbrella, too. But we're going to talk about the music industry. Talk to me about the research that went into this episode.
Yeah, I mean, we joke all the time that we're like a math show because we have so many numbers all the time, like we're figuring out percentages or like industry trends and stuff. And this episode with Shua was part of a two-part series kind of about musicians and the reality of the music economy. So with another episode with Juliana Zaccaria, we really went deep on Spotify and streaming. And with Shua, we were looking more at like the overall like idea of being what's called a cultural worker. And so for that, we talked to the scholar. He's based at the University of Leeds in the UK about, he studies media, music, and culture. And he has a lot to say. He's written a lot about cultural workers and the way that people in, you know, general society treat them or like what expectations they have for them and how like that's evolved throughout history. Like you think about the way that people made a living as creative people in the olden days too. And so that was really great. Like we read his work, Anthony and I read his work and talked to him about what it is that shapes the music economy. And yeah, reflecting on why we just kind of want it for free. Like we want to experience music for free. We want to like have access to art. But also we want our musicians to be well taken care of. We want them to be able to keep making art. But yeah, this like glorified idea of the starving artist is there, like it's real. And maybe that gives us a little bit of permission to, think differently about the economics of it. So yeah, we did so much research on the trends and the numbers, where music sales have transformed over the years as well, like the evolution into streaming culture and ultimately the impact on the workers, on the musicians themselves.
Absolutely. I like that point a lot, Julia. My question really formally for you after that was going to be what stayed with you, even though, you know, as you speak, you kind of get into what stayed with you. But yes, I think the comment you made about, you know, why do we expect art or music or things that are come from a creative place instead of a, you know, get this done in 16 hours or else. Why do we expect things like that to be free? I think that that could be an episode in itself. I think that could be a yearly segment. You know, let's check back in on the numbers, you know, since people aren't happy sometimes with the murals and the pop-ups. And it's like, well, did you donate? Did you did you give money to your local artists? Did you go to a pop-up show? Did you, you know, support a struggling artist? Or, you know, were you just kind of looking for all this creative, beautiful things that cost money in a real world that we live in.
And, like, what is the role of, like, the infrastructure, too? Like, one thing that Shua talked about was, like, Beethoven and how Vienna, like, funded him and paid him, like, to force him to live there. I wouldn't say force, but they, like, you know, encouraged him to live in Vienna by and create his art. And so, like, what's the role of like, the municipalities in this and, like, supporting this ecosystem, too?
Absolutely. No. One of my favorite artists, Zora Neale Hurston, and reading up on her life, once again, had somebody who was funding and helping and, you know, this art and these words and these books, whether you're a novelist or a muralist or you're just a creative in general, it doesn't come for free. You know, these, you know, we've all been to the Creative Michaels stores and look for the tools and you put it in your cart and you got $100, you know, and you were really just trying to, I was trying to just paint a window, you know, so I couldn't imagine trying to do an entire album or mural, you know, so thank you. That caused us to think. Once again, this was Julia Dixon Evans here with us on Best of KPBS Podcast. Thank you so much for your time, Julia.
Thank you, Lawrence.
You just heard an episode from The Finest Podcast featuring local musician Shua. You can listen to this episode and many more from The Finest wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us. This is Best of KPBS Podcast. You've been listening to Best of KPBS Podcast. Each episode brings you extended clips from some of KPBS's most compelling podcasts, along with conversations that take you behind the scenes of the journalism and storytelling that make these programs possible. Best of KPBS Podcast is a production of the KPBS Audio Department. This episode of Best of KPBS Podcast was written and produced by Adrian Villalobos. The executive producer and editor is Lisa Jane Morissette, the director of audio programming and operations, with additional editorial support coming from senior producer Brooke Ruth. Music was composed by Ben Rudlosk, and today's guest, Port of Entry producer Julio Ortiz Franco and Julia Dixon Evans, the host of The Finest. And I'm Lawrence K. Jackson. Thanks for listening.